This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. More than 17,000 people in Baltimore are addicted to an illegal substance. That's about 3.3% of the population, higher than the national average. We wanted to find out what challenges do those people face in beating these addictions, what factors can affect whether someone can be successful in recovery, and what sort of stigma do they face. Joining me now to speak about this is Trina Morris, Outreach Coordinator for the Recovery Network University Psychological Center. She works with people with addiction problems here in Baltimore. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'm also joined by Carl Lejeune, Director of the Center for Addictions, Personality, and Emotion Research at the University of Maryland College Park. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
And on the line from Louisville is Monica Williams, Associate Director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities at the University of Louisville. She's written about stereotypes of addicts. Thanks for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Carl, what is addiction? What happens in the brain when someone takes these sorts of drugs?
At a neural level, this can involve a lot of things in terms of negatively affecting the dopamine system and serotonin. But for the most part, what we want to think about is that the way that people who aren't addicted to drugs may experience positive things or may cope with negative things, when you've been using drugs for a long time and it reaches the point of an addiction, it becomes essentially very hard at a neural level to respond in the same way that in the same positive way that those who are not addicted.
Are some people physically more likely to become addicted than others?
Well, yeah, certainly there is an individual difference in terms of this. There's also a drug difference in terms of this. Certain drugs, such as heroin, have a much greater physical addictive profile than, say, other drugs like cocaine. It is important to say, though, that beyond physical withdrawal, there's also what we would think of as psychological withdrawal, and that is really a part of all drugs. And in many cases, that can be just as powerful as the physical withdrawal.
I want to get back to that, but let me ask Trina Morris. You work in West Baltimore and with some of those, you see some of those 17,000 people every day.
Yes.
Tell me something about them. Tell me about the people you work with, what their addictions tend to be, what their economic circumstances tend to be.
Well, I work specifically with the population at Lexington Market. And in that area, the drug of choice seems to be prescription medication. Also, methadone, Suboxone, and marijuana are the drugs of choice in that area. The people in that area that are addicted to those substances, they come from an array of backgrounds. Every socioeconomic status, from homeowners to homeless individuals, from employed individuals at local hospitals and other businesses in the area to unemployed individuals, all educational levels. I even see students, college students, that are there purchasing illegal substances. So drug abuse doesn't have a specific face. It can target anyone who's craving a need to be addicted to a substance.
Monica, what Trina's just described is no stereotype, but a lot of us do function with stereotypes of drug addicts, and you've looked at some of the stereotypes, especially dealing with addiction and race. Tell me about that.
Yes, so when you ask the typical person to imagine a drug user or a drug dealer, most people are going to think of an African American. But in fact, African Americans are much less likely to use drugs than Caucasians or Hispanic Americans. And in fact, African Americans spend less money on alcohol and are much less likely to have youth that have substance abuse problems as well. And this is from the Centers of Disease Control and long-term studies, national epidemiological studies that have, that have validated these things.
So you're saying a lot of our stereotypes diverge from the reality. What powers the stereotypes then? Why do we do that?
Well, people hear a lot of messages about minorities, and in fact, some of these messages are things that make us feel a little better about social inequities because we think, well, if these people are doing these bad things, i.e. selling drugs, taking drugs, committing crimes so that they have money to buy drugs, then they must deserve the punishment they get. In other words, it makes sense then that they're overrepresented in drug courts and in prison. And if we reconcile ourselves with the truth that, in fact, African Americans, for example, are less likely to use and sell drugs, then we've got to step back and say, what's wrong with our society? Why are Black people filling our jails and white people who may be convicted of the same crime not serving the same amount of time?
Carl, I want to get back to your point about kind of part of why people put themselves in a position to become addicted. I mean, essentially, you seem to be saying people medicate themselves for a reason.
Well, yeah. So in our lab, we do a fair amount of basic research, but we're just as committed to doing work, implementing this into the community. And in the context of that, we first spent a lot of time working with local community drug use centers and running drug use groups and really trying to make sure that we're not just studying it at an academic level, but also at the level of the individual. And a lot of the, getting back to the idea of stereotypes, but more about the individual, there were many things that we found out that were really somewhat surprising. And most of this came through a group that we actually called Why Drugs Are Good. And the purpose of this was not obviously to say drugs are good, but to figure out in the least judgmental way possible why the individuals that we were working with had started using these drugs and why it was so hard for them to stop. Because when you think about the negative consequences, it's very easy for someone who's not caught in this to think, oh, it must be so easy to stop because it's hurting you so much, it's hurting others around you. And what you actually find is that there are many things about the drug that have very powerful and in many cases positive effects. Sometimes these are in terms of self-medicating, as you mentioned, and it's also important to keep in mind that oftentimes people don't have access or awareness of some of the resources that many others have in terms of dealing with problems. And so, for instance, we're doing a study with individuals who are using heroin to medicate their anxiety. And we're not just talking about nervousness or minor anxiety. We're talking about very severe panic attacks to the point where someone really feels like they're dying. And heroin is the only thing that makes them feel safe or whole. And when the person stops using drugs, especially if they're not really understanding what their anxiety is, all these problems come back. And so the drug has this kind of power over the individual because, oddly, it's the only thing that makes them really feel, as I said before, like comfortable and safe. On the other side, there's also, you start to have a certain culture that comes with your drug use. You start to have certain friends, you start to have certain environments, and it becomes really hard to then, when you move away from that, to assimilate back into settings where people aren't using drugs. And so sometimes it's easy to forget that they're in the moment, there really are some positives and some reasons beyond just the physical withdrawal why people are using.
Again, in terms of stereotypes, addiction and crime often run together. When people look at someone who has been addicted, but some people would say that, stigma exists for a reason, that drug abuse is an awful thing and people should be afraid of what happens because of it. I mean, is there a way to keep that message and still respect the people who are dealing with the problem?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. And I think that the key here is remembering that people who use and abuse drugs are human beings like everyone else. And when we think about a drug abuser and we think about some of the unsavory terms we use to describe them, these are very dehumanizing. And in fact, people with substance abuse problems are just like anyone else. They may have any other type of problem, any other type of mental health problem or physical problem. There's just happens to involve substances. And so when we think about them as human beings, then we can see and understand that they're not necessarily all criminals or they're not necessarily people we should avoid and fear and hate. In fact, addicts are in every walk of life, as Trina pointed out earlier, including attorneys, judges, doctors. Addicts are everywhere, but in our minds, we see these criminals, and so we're afraid of them.
There is a website based in Baltimore called That Guy's on Heroin, and I don't know whether you've seen that, Trina or Carl.
Yes.
It features pictures of people on the street who look like they're probably on heroin. People take photos, send them in. The blogger ranks them in kind of a snarky way, mocking the people who seem zoned out. But Carl, what kind of effect does that kind of site have?
Well, I think the problem is, and I think everyone has said this really nicely, is that it starts to make us lose sight of the idea that there's a function behind someone's drug use. It's easy to just look at someone and say, well, drug use is their only problem. This is the only issue. This defines who they are. And when you have sites like this, that's exactly what's happening. But in reality, there's many other things going on, and it's much harder for us to take the time to understand that. And I've felt very fortunate in the situations that we've been in, interviewing, doing these long interviews with individuals and walking away just feeling so different about and almost guilty and badly about the stereotypes that come to you. And you know, I can think of getting back to this idea we were talking before about physical withdrawal, but then also the psychological withdrawal. I think that's an important thing, too, in terms of remembering that addiction in many ways is really just about someone trying to get what they need. And other people may have found more effective ways to do that. But for some individuals, especially if you think of a drug like cocaine that doesn't have, say, the physical withdrawal profile, but might make the individual feel much more comfortable with things that they're doing, it brings them energy, it gives them a sense of community. I know these things are hard to kind of understand unless you really talk to someone, but I remember we had a woman one time, and she was a grandmother, actually, and she had been using cocaine her whole life, and she had been clean for quite a while, and she was holding down a job and doing great, and she had this big project due, and her boss was very kind of unpredictable, fired people a lot, and so she had to get this project done, and her daughter got sick, and she had to leave work and all the other things that happen in life. And she was extremely worried by the time that she had gotten out of the emergency room, it was midnight, that she wasn't going to be able to get this project done. And she's sitting there thinking, the only thing that I can think of that will allow me to stay up all night and get this project done is cocaine. This is the only thing that I know that will help me here. And it doesn't mean that that's the right choice or that others may not have come up with a better choice. But when you think about what she was experiencing there, this wasn't about being a criminal. This wasn't about being selfish or lazy. This was about someone who felt like she had very few choices and was really trying to do what was right for herself and her family. And unfortunately, you can guess how that went. But it was that story always sticks with me in terms of remembering that there's many, many reasons why someone uses. And it's not just the obvious things that this kind of a site kind of leads us to think about.
Monica, let me pull you into this in terms of, I guess, stereotypes and how it looks to the outside. I mean, is the whole picture of addiction different for people who are without resources than for people who have resources?
Oh, absolutely. Because when someone has an addiction problem and they don't have resources, people automatically assume that the reason they don't have resources is because they're an addict, because they're not working or contributing, or because they're leading a life of crime. Now, of course, these things can be true of people of higher SES as well, but we have the attitude that, well, if that person is without resources, it's probably because they deserve it, which may be very, very far from the truth.
Later on the show, we're going to meet Mike Perry, who works for a nonprofit here in Baltimore. He's a former heroin addict, and he told us yesterday about why he decided to stop using heroin.
My family, I was doing so much harm to my family, you know. Seeing my mom catch me in the bathroom with a needle in my arm and then my neck when I couldn't find veins in my arm anymore, seeing her cry was enough to get me off of it.
Trina, what does it take for someone to decide to stop using?
They have this term that they use, which is a person has to reach their bottom. But each person's bottom differs. Some people, unfortunately, have to lose their children to foster care or to the CPS system to decide enough is enough. Other people may lose a limb or lose a loved one or become homeless to decide that enough is enough. It varies depending on the individual. I have worked with some people who have experienced some horrible things that would make you think, I would have stopped this a long time ago. And this is the insanity of the addiction. It doesn't affect everyone the same way. Some people really have to go through some very life-changing, very uncomfortable situations to decide that they're ready to turn their life around. And the hope for a counselor is that the individual will make it back into treatment in enough time to do that. Unfortunately, some people lose their lives out there.
We have talked about how some of addiction is chemistry in the body. Some of it is people trying to cope. It's not a level playing field. I mean, we can say that it's not fair to judge addiction as a moral failing, as so much of society does. But, and I throw this out to anyone who wants to address it, I mean, with the system we have in place now, is there anything except personal responsibility that can pull somebody out of it? I mean, we can say it's more than personal responsibility, but ultimately, isn't that what it takes?
In society, we really have to work on our humanity. We do a lot of blaming the victim. In some situations, substance abusers have become victims. In some situations, this may have been normalcy. This is what they've seen. This is what their parents have done in front of them from the time they were children, and now they're adults, and they're repeating the same cycle. Some individuals have used drugs with their parents, people who are supposed to set an example for you. I think that we don't do enough talking to individuals to find out what their story is. Everyone has a story. And a unique thing about us being different is that my experiences may have kept me from that lifestyle. However, I may be able to share with you how you can better yourself, how you can use certain coping skills or reach out to certain networks that can empower you and give you a sense of hope, something that an individual who's addicted to drugs may never have experienced before, something as simple as hope or a positive word being said. I think that that lack of humanity keeps the distance between those who are in addiction and those who are not. The sad thing is that anything in life can happen to any of us, and we can find ourselves doing something that we never in our wildest dreams imagined we would do. It's my hope that I would never pick up a substance abuse or abuse any drug. And that's always my hope, because I've seen individuals who never thought that that would be a part of their journey. And for some reason, they have found themselves there. And, you know, we're just not a humble society. Unfortunately, we are judgmental. We really need to work on that humanity and remembering that none of us are invincible. None of us. Drugs doesn't have a age. It doesn't attack a certain race or a certain gender. We're all susceptible because we never know what life is going to throw at us. So I think we really have to keep that in the forefront and keep that in mind.
I really want to thank all of you for this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carl Lesway is director of the Center for Addictions, Personality, and Emotion Research at the University of Maryland. Monica Williams is associate director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities at the University of Louisville. And Trina Morris is outreach coordinator for the Recovery Network University Psychological Center. She works with people with addiction problems in Baltimore. We have more information on our website, thelinesbetweenus.org. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on The Lines Between Us, theater as the tool to defeat prison violence. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Welcome back. On 88.1, it's The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Maryland prisons are in the national news this week after a federal indictment alleged that both inmates and correctional officers inside the Baltimore City Detention Center were involved in a massive criminal conspiracy, among other things. Today, we take a look at something else happening inside Maryland prisons, something dramaturgical. Before this indictment came to light, we talked to two men helping inmates at a Western Maryland prison put on a play. In 2007, the theater artist Bashi Rose began working with inmates at the Maryland Correctional Training Center in Hagerstown, using role-playing, improvisation, and other theater techniques. Rose is an Open Society Institute and Black Male Achievement Fellow, and the co-founder of Nomo Theater. Since 2007, his work with incarcerated people has expanded to include programs at prisons in Jessup as well. The program is called DRAMA, for Direct Responses Alleviate Misdirected Aggression. The group has developed a new play written by Kelly Franklin, an inmate in Hagerstown. It's called The N-Word, and it'll be performed at the prison on Monday afternoon and again on May 6th. Bashi Rose joins me in the studio.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks. Also with us is Mike Perry. He is a founding member of the drama group at MCTC. He's a program assistant now with the American Friends Service Committee, working with the Friend of a Friend Mentoring Project, which addresses prison violence. Welcome, Mike Perry.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So, Bashi, give us an overview of drama, this program that you're doing in the prisons.
Yeah, well, like you mentioned, it started in 2007. And I was going through the prison as an intern, helping out with the Friend of a Friend program. And Mike Perry and some of the other brothers expressed an interest in theater. And so they got together and started the drama program. We started meeting two Tuesdays every month. And we started out again as doing improv. And our first production was a combination of excerpts of Fences by August Wilson, original poetry, and short original skits that the men did. So it's an opportunity for them, you know, to express themselves creatively, to you know, discuss a lot of different issues in a, you know, creative environment. And it's an environment where they, I observe they, you know, create a sense of freedom for themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, they create their own world.
So there are things that they can do using theater techniques that you don't think they can accomplish in other ways.
Well, I think what theater brings to it specifically, it allows them to break down a lot of inhibitions you may have in the prison environment. It allows them to, you know, really be themselves and express sides of themselves that otherwise they wouldn't feel comfortable, you know, expressing. Also, it allows men of different ages and different generations, backgrounds, you know, from different parts of the city. Some of the men from New York, some of the men from D.C., who otherwise wouldn't come together, to come together, you know, saying to do something together as one.
Mm-hmm. And this play that you're co-directing with the guy who wrote the play, Kelly Franklin, is called The N-Word. What is the subject matter? Obviously, it's a very heated
yeah.
title and the word, yeah.
Yeah, so basically, of course, you know, dealing with the N-Word. It came about, the men started talking about the N-Word, having discussions about it. And so the group, the age range is maybe from 19 all the way up maybe to 50. So you had different perspectives on the N-Word. So they would have discussion. Then they would improv, go back, have more discussion. Then some of the men brought in some poetry from the last poets, some debates by some intellectuals talking about the use of the N-Word. And then they had more discussion, more improv. And then Kelly Franklin stepped up and started actually, you know, writing a play based on the conversations and the improv. And the N-Word, basically, the gist of the play is a teacher by the name of Mr. Imus, who has a history of using harsh language towards his students, is accused by his students of calling him the N-word.
And he has written the whole play. He's written the script. This is not an improv piece, then.
No, he's written the script. Yeah. Some of the script, has been altered as a result of improv. But initially, he was just an actor and observer in the group. And during this process, he stepped up as writer and co-director.
Yeah. And Mike Perry, the friend of a friend mentoring project that is run by, that you work with the American Friends Service Committee. How does that program function?
Fantastic. It brought an atmosphere into the prison environment that was conspicuously absent, because it seemed like they were trying to enhance gang violence and fights between the gangs. But when the Friends group came in, boy, they minimized a lot of the damage. Aberrant behavior patterns the young dudes were engaged in, they minimized all that. And it seemed like it was a perfect storm when we met Bashi, who brought in the drama component because it gave the guys an artistic outlet. A lot of the young guys had expertise and creativity that they never even thought they had. Bashi was able to tap into it.
How does the Friend of a Friend mentoring project work? Are you pairing up people? You putting people together to mentor and counsel each other?
Initially, the older guys came together, men like myself, and we knew that there was an absence of father-type figures and mentoring going on in the general population. We picked mentees, younger guys that we wanted to work with over a six-month period. The curriculum consists of effective communication, conflict resolution, choices, peer pressure, self-esteem issues, gender issues, and we plugged it in to drama, because guys could actually see themselves depicted by virtue of the arts, and they would say, wow, I didn't know I looked that stupid talking to the CO on the I didn't know I sounded that bad talking to my wife on the phone, It brought to life stuff that they were actually going through on the tier and on the compound.
Mm-hmm. Bashi goes, conflict resolution, obviously a big part of prison life. How do you counsel people? How do you deal with, two guys who don't like each other? How do you make it work?
Well, the example Mike and I were talking about earlier in the drama group, you had one of the oldest gentlemen in the group. We were doing the August Wilson piece Fences, then the youngest gentleman in the group. And it was a clash of ideas, clash of age, and a clash of perspective, clash of artistic differences. So what happened was, over the process of doing the play, when we really got into reading the play and get into the dramaturgy of the play and the history of it and really had serious discussions, that's when those walls started breaking down, because they were able to relate to one another more. And then, ironically, the young brother ended up playing Corey, the young man in the play, and the older brother ended up playing Troy, mm-hmm. So it really broke down those barriers, and it was a concrete example, of conflict being alleviated through theater.
Bashi Rose is the facilitator of a theater group that works with incarcerated individuals. Mike Perry is a program assistant with the American Friends Service Committee, who works with the Friend of a Friend mentoring program in Maryland prisons. The N-Word, a play written by an inmate at the Maryland Correctional Training Center in Hagerstown, will receive its premiere at that prison later this month. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to The Lines Between Us. Bashi Rose, so many people incarcerated are incarcerated for nonviolent drug crimes. From your perspective as an artist working with these populations in all these different prisons, what is your take on their experience when they are put into what is a fairly violent, very difficult, tense situation for sometimes many, many years? What's the effect on these nonviolent criminals who go in and are put in the same population with people who have been charged with violent crimes?
Well, if they don't have the opportunity to, to meet a brother like Mike Perry in the prison or an opportunity to, join a positive program, a lot of times, sometimes they end up joining street organizations that they may feel serve their best interests initially, but once they get inside the organizations, it's the opposite. And they end up becoming involved in something they can't get out of, So it ends up, creating that cycle, reoccurring cycle of violence in the prison system.
Right. And you are working with, when it comes to gangs and those organizations, are you working with people in the same theater group who are in different gangs?
In the same production. Same thing in Friend of a Friend mentoring program. You have people from different sets or whatever you want to call them in one room.
and it's been successful. I mean, you've seen results. You've seen that people are backing away from the allegiances to the gangs.
Yeah, definitely. I think Mike Perry can speak more on some specific examples.
You know, the cliche "idle mind is the devil's workshop" is real because they try to minimize programming, and then you have absence of activity, such as the friends group and the drama group. So then you have exasperated violence in the prison system. Mm-hmm. But it definitely minimized a whole lot of violence in these joints. You know what I mean? You have BGF brothers, some Bloods and some Crips, and the friend of a friend group. You know, initially you come in with blinders on it. They don't like each other. Communication is enhanced. You start being more sensitive to where other folks are and recognize that the depression that you're under affects each and everybody in the group.
Real quick, another example at JCI, Jessup Correctional Institution, some years ago, we partnered with Moonwork, which is another a cultural theater program in Baltimore City, by Mama Kay and Mama Rashida. They came in, they brought in a whole crew of actors, and they did a piece, a gang violence prevention piece. They collaborated with the whole group of the Friend of a Friend members, the mentors and mentees, and they specifically, Marshall Eddie Conway, and other mentors in the Friend of a Friend program specifically invited leaders from different gangs to come to to come in the audience. And after the play, all these brothers were coming together, coming up to the actors, you know, telling them, man, you know what I'm saying? The way you represented it was just so accurate and real. The sense of love was just, you know, vibrant there. And for weeks and months afterwards, on my way to the Friend of a Friend program, guys that whose faces I remembered who were in the audience would come up to me, thanking me. And thanking us and thanking Mama K and them for putting on that show, you know? Mm-hmm. So it definitely has a positive effect.
I mean, I would think that one of the big challenges is that if someone, especially someone who's incarcerated for a long term, a life term, or a very long sentence, is how do you instill a sense of hope and optimism and you know, an outlook for the future in a guy who's facing that kind of a period of incarceration?
That's the necessity of the program because they bring a vestige of hope with them. When the Friend of a Friend came into Hagerstown, I wanted to shout and say, yippee, because I felt something decent coming into the system. You know, I knew
this
I had.
This is while you were incarcerated.
While I was still in prison. Yeah, mm-hmm. I knew something vital was coming to that. If the whole week was bad, Wednesday I knew I was going to get some relief. I was going to get some love. I was going to get some hope. You know what I mean? And that carried me through the whole tenure of my bit this time. You know, and it's felt through everybody that's in this program.
Mm-hmm. And Bashi, I mean, obviously jobs and opportunity, education, you know, workforce training are a big important part of reducing recidivism rates and that kind of thing. But let's just talk about Department of Corrections. I mean, assume, you know, for the moment, let's leave the job training bit of it out of it. I mean, assuming that's a separate issue, how could policy regarding prisons be changed in your estimation, you know, to make the time that people are serving in prison lead to success when they are released?
Definitely more access to education. And also actually listening to the men inside the prison, the men who are incarcerated, allowing them to have a say, to have an input, you know what I'm saying, in the educational programs that are there. And also, you know, in order for them to take advantage of any programs that are there, the violence has to be decreased. You know what I'm saying? If you're in a violent environment, how are you going to really take advantage of education? And I think allowing the men to really be the one to take the lead in doing away with the violence in the prisons and helping the gangs come together, that's the way to effectively do it, rather having people coming from the outside. So
it's got to come from within.
Definitely.
Definitely. Well, Bashi Rose, Mike Perry, I really appreciate your time this morning. Great conversation. Appreciate your coming. Bashi Rose and Mike Perry are part of a program called DRAMA, or Direct Responses Alleviate Misdirected Aggression. The N-Word by inmate Kelly Franklin will be performed twice at the Maryland Correctional Training Center in Hagerstown on April 29th and again on May 6th. Performances are at 4 o'clock in the afternoon both days. Outside guests are welcome to attend, but you have to register. You can do that at linesbetweenus.org, where you can also find previous episodes of the series and tell us what inequality in our region looks like from where you are. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. This has been The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.